She was looking at him silently, respectfully. Her joyous eagerness toned down, her eyes subdued. He felt better. He picked up his drink, took a gulp, and chuckled abruptly at a sudden recollection. "It was funny, though," he said, his tone easier, livelier, the tone of a confidence to a pal. "You should have seen Orrin Boyle yesterday when the first flash came through on the radio from Wyatt Junction. He turned green, but I mean green, the color of a fish that's been lying around too long. Do you know what he did last night, by way of taking the bad news? Hired himself a suite at the Valhalla Hotel, and you know what that is. And the last I heard, he was still there today, drinking himself under the table and the beds, with a few choice friends of his and half the female population of Upper Amsterdam Avenue." "Who is Mr. Boyle?" she asked, stupefied. "Oh, a fat slob that's inclined to overreach himself. A smart guy who gets too smart at times. You should have seen his face yesterday. I got a kick out of that. That and Dr. Floyd Ferris. That smoothie didn't like it a bit. Oh, not a bit. The elegant Dr. Ferris of the State Science Institute. The servant of the people with the patent leather vocabulary. But he carried it off pretty well, I must say. Only you could see him squirming in every paragraph. I mean that interview he gave out this morning where he said, 'The country gave Reardon that medal. Now we expect him to give the country something in return.' That was pretty nifty, considering who's been riding on the gravy train, and, well, considering. That was better than Bertram Scudder. Mr. Scudder couldn't think of anything but no comment when his fellow gentleman of the press asked him to voice his sentiments. No comment from Bertram Scudder, who's never been known to shut his trap from the day he was born, about anything you ask him or don't ask. Abyssinian poetry, or the state of the ladies' restrooms in the textile industry. And Dr. Pritchett, the old fool, is going around saying that he knows for certain that Reardon didn't invent that metal, because he was told by an unnamed reliable source that Reardon stole the formula from a penniless inventor whom he murdered." He was chuckling happily. She was listening as to a lecture on higher mathematics, grasping nothing, not even the style of the language, a style which made the mystery greater, because she was certain that it did not mean, coming from him, what it would have meant anywhere else. He refilled his glass and drained it, but his gaiety vanished abruptly. He slumped into an armchair, facing her, looking up at her from under his bald forehead, his eyes blurred. "She's coming back tomorrow," he said, with a sound like a chuckle devoid of amusement. "Who?" "My sister. My dear sister. Oh, she'll think she's great, won't she?" "You dislike your sister, Mr. Taggart?" He made the same sound. Its meaning was so eloquent that she needed no other answer. "Why?" she asked. "Because she thinks she's so good. What right is she to think it? What right has anybody to think he's good? Nobody's any good." "You don't mean it, Mr. Taggart." "I mean we're only human beings. And what's a human being? A weak, ugly, sinful creature, born that way, rotten in his bones. So humility is the one virtue we ought to practice. He ought to spend his life on his knees, begging to be forgiven for his dirty existence. When a man thinks he's good, that's when he's rotten. Pride is the worst of all sins, no matter what he's done." "But if a man knows that what he's done is good, then he ought to apologize for it." "To whom?" "To those who haven't done it."
I don't understand."
"Of course you don't. It takes years and years of study in the higher reaches of the intellect. Have you ever heard of The Metaphysical Contradictions of the Universe by Dr. Simon Pritchett?" She shook her head, frightened. "How do you know what's good, anyway?" "Who knows what's good? Who can ever know? There are no absolutes, as Dr. Pritchett has proved irrefutably. Nothing is absolute. Everything is a matter of opinion. How do you know that the bridge hasn't collapsed? You only think it hasn't. How do you know that there's any bridge at all? You think that a system of philosophy such as Dr. Pritchett's is just something academic, remote, impractical? But it isn't. Oh, boy, how it isn't."
"But, Mr. Taggart, the line you built..."
"Oh, what's that line, anyway? It's only a material achievement. Is that of any importance? Is there any greatness in anything material? Only a low animal can gape at that bridge, when there are so many higher things in life. But do the higher things ever get recognition? Oh, no. Look at people. All that hue and cry and front pages about some trick arrangement of some scraps of matter. Do they care about any nobler issue? Do they ever give front pages to a phenomenon of the spirit? Do they notice or appreciate a person of finer sensibility? And you wonder whether it's true that a great man is doomed to unhappiness in this depraved world. He leaned forward, staring at her intently. I'll tell you something. Unhappiness is the hallmark of virtue. If a man is unhappy, really, truly unhappy, it means that he is a superior sort of person. He saw the puzzled, anxious look of her face. But, Mr. Taggart, you got everything you wanted. Now you have the best railroad in the country. The newspapers call you the greatest business executive of the age. They say the stock of your company made a fortune for you overnight. You got everything you could ask for. Aren't you glad of it? In the brief space of his answer, she felt frightened, sensing a sudden fear within him. He answered, "No." She didn't know why her voice dropped to a whisper. "You'd rather the bridge had collapsed?" "I haven't said that," he snapped sharply. Then he shrugged and waved his hand in a gesture of contempt. "You don't understand." "I'm sorry." "Oh, I know that I have such an awful lot to learn. I am talking about a hunger for something much beyond that bridge, a hunger that nothing material will ever satisfy." "What, Mr. Taggart? What is it you want?" "Oh, there you go. The moment you ask, what is it, you're back in the crude, material world where everything's got to be tagged and measured. I'm speaking of things that can't be named in materialistic words, the higher realms of the spirit which man can never reach. What's any human achievement, anyway? The earth is only an atom whirling in the universe. But what importance is that bridge to the solar system?" A sudden happy look of understanding cleared her eyes. "It's great of you, Mr. Taggart, to think that your own achievement isn't good enough for you. I guess no matter how far you've gone, you want to go still further. You're ambitious. That's what I admire most. Ambition, I mean, doing things. Not stopping and giving up, but doing. I understand, Mr. Taggart, even if I don't understand all the big thoughts. You'll learn." "Oh, I'll work very hard to learn." Her glance of admiration had not changed. He walked across the room, moving in that glance, as in a gentle spotlight. He went to refill his glass. A mirror hung in the niche behind the portable bar. He caught a glimpse of his own figure, the tall body distorted by a sloppy, sagging posture, as if in deliberate negation of human grace, the thinning hair, the soft, sullen mouth. It struck him suddenly that she did not see him at all. What she saw was the heroic figure of a builder, with proudly straight shoulders and wind-blown hair. He chuckled aloud, feeling that this was a good joke on her, feeling dimly a satisfaction that resembled a sense of victory, the superiority of having put something over on her. Sipping his drink, he glanced at the door of his bedroom and thought of the usual ending for an adventure of this kind. He thought that it would be easy. The girl was too awed to resist. He saw the reddish-bronze sparkle of her hair as she sat head bent under a light, and a wedge of smooth glowing skin on her shoulder. He looked away. Why bother? He thought. The hint of desire that he felt was no more than a sense of physical discomfort. The sharpest impulse in his mind, nagging him to action, was not the thought of the girl, but of all the men who would not pass up an opportunity of this kind. He admitted to himself that she was a much better person than Betty Pope, perhaps the best person ever offered to him. The admission left him indifferent. He felt no more than he had felt for Betty Pope. He felt nothing. The prospect of experiencing pleasure was not worth the effort. He had no desire to experience pleasure. "It's getting late," he said. "Where do you live? Let me give you another drink, and then I'll take you home." When he said goodbye to her at the door of a miserable rooming house in a slum neighborhood, she hesitated, fighting not to ask a question which she desperately wished to ask him.